And welcome back to this National Flashpoint special teach-in on the threat of war against Iraq and the U.S. and world resistance to it. And folks, if you haven't heard, the people came out in numbers across this country and around this world standing up and against this rush to war. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Again, this is a Flashpoint special, and you're listening to a three-hour teach-in on the war and the myths and realities. We're going to be dealing with civil liberties, civil rights. We're going to be dealing in this hour specifically with what I considered the biggest lie and the biggest untold story, which is how the occupation, the Israeli occupation of Palestine, fits into this puzzle and the meaning of that, and how, if this war goes ahead, the suffering that we see in Palestine is only going to be expanded. But first, before we get to our to this next segment, we do have a studio audience here at KPFA Pacifica 94.1. That's them. And we're going to invite them up to the microphone and see if we can get some questions from them and comments. Please.
Hi, I'm Michael Oster. I have kind of a question and a comment. One of the most undiscussed issues is the water of the Tigris and Euphrates River, which is a gold mine when you consider that it's more important to oil than oil to people because you can't drink oil. And as I understand it, Ariel Sharon has plans to pipe the water from the Tigris and Euphrates all the way down to Israel, and so they need all that clear access to that river.
Do either one of you want to talk about water, Joel?
Actually, that's not a reason to go to war against Iraq. The plan to ship waters from the Tigris depends on shipping it from the headwaters of the Tigris, which are in Turkey. And so far, that hasn't been done because it's financially infeasible. Technologically, the plans are there. Bags of plastic that will be towed behind large boats full of water. It's all on the drawing boards, but so far it's just financially unfeasible, and it doesn't need a war on Iraq to implement.
But that's Professor Joel Manin, Middle East History at Stanford University. Lamisa, you want to respond to the water?
Well, I think the water is more important to Sharon in Lebanon and in the West Bank. So if there's no withdrawal, and even if there's withdrawal, according to the infamous Camp David proposal, water would still be under Israeli control. And one of the underreported stories in the news last fall was the Israeli threats to attack Lebanon over water. So this could be another chapter after the war in Iraq under the pretext of attacking Hezbollah.
That was Lamisa Andoni. Yes, next question.
Hi, I'm Bob Sarnoff, and I'm in the audience. And one of my concerns as a volunteer in the anti-war movement is how little I've heard about our outreach to people that aren't already with us. One thing I remember from the anti-Vietnam War days were the so-called Free the Army shows, where people mobilized to counter the propaganda that was being delivered to the troops. And another thing is that I don't see as much outreach into the so-called red zone, that vast underpopulated portion of America that went for Bush. So I'm curious about the kind of efforts that people might be directing in that direction.
Joel Dana.
Well, I'm from Palo Alto, which is not Berkeley, as some of you probably know. And 2 weeks ago, we had a demonstration of 5,000 people in Palo Alto, the largest demonstration in the history of Palo Alto against the war. So that says to me that lots of people who are not typically mobilized in activities like demonstrations are, in fact, being reached. On the other hand, Bob raises some important issues. We haven't heard much about anti-war demonstrations in Wyoming, where Dick Cheney is from, and places like that. And then there's a much bigger issue about the character of the Army today. One of the things that made it possible to put on those Free the Army shows was that you had a draft Army. You had a lot of people in the Army who didn't want to be there. And if you'd put up something reasonably attractive and entertaining, they'd come off the base and see it. That's much more difficult to do now. We have a much less democratic military structure, and it makes that kind of organizing more difficult, and we need to think about how to do it.
And before we take the next question, I want to let people know that Davey D. of Hard Knock Radio is standing by, and we're going to be talking more with young people and more about how to get more people involved, people who might not have typically been involved or who weren't alive during the Vietnam War. So that's coming up, but it's a great question.
Hello, my name is Alice Mosley. I live in San Francisco, and it's really to back up what the previous questioner had said. I think that there is a chasm in information between what we who are fortunate enough to be able to hear KPFA, the information that we get, and many Americans. And I think that's part of the reason why there's even more protest in many of the European countries. Their media is not quite so controlled as ours. And one example I'd like journalists here to go back to is Bertolt Brecht, the great German playwright who opposed the Nazi regime. What he did was he took a speech by Goebbels, and one might perhaps here think of the President's State of the Union message or Colin Powell's addressing the UN.
Goebbels, the information minister, the master of propaganda for the Third Reich.
That's right. And what Bertolt Brecht did was he took a speech that he made and he reconstructed the truth, every line, line for line, to show what the truth really was. And I think that one really needs to do that for what it's been done in various places, for what Colin Powell said. But there are a lot of people who said, well, perhaps he's right. Perhaps, you know, we do need to do something about Saddam. And yet, if you took it line by line, you'd see that there was very little factual information in it, and we can certainly rebut absolutely everything that he said there.
All right. Anybody want to respond to Goebbels? I could tell you, though, I was looking at, we're going to have some poetry later on. I was looking at a poem by Bertolt Brecht, a beautiful piece of poetry. It was after Laura Bush canceled the White House poetry reading because she thought it was a very bad idea to mix politics and poetry. I don't know whose phone that is, but please shut off your cell phones wherever you are. The poem was about by Brecht, and it was about how this guy was lamenting because he was watching as all the donkeys were pulling all the books to be burned, and his name was not on the list of books to be burned. And he was thinking, hadn't I spoken out enough? Hadn't I said enough? Wasn't I political enough? How dare them leave my name off that list of books to be burned? Anyway, my name is Dennis Bernstein, and you're listening to Pacifica Radio. This is a live anti-war teach-in, and we are trying to give information that the mainstream media would not typically give you. We're going to turn our focus now to Israel and Palestine. The real story that has not been covered. And before we do that, we have a piece of tape. We interviewed Kristen Schura, who spoke to us. She is an independent reporter and a special correspondent for Flashpoints. And she has been between Gaza and Ramallah and Bethlehem. She was locked into that church in Bethlehem, the Church of the Nativity, when the Israelis were surrounding it and trying, I guess, to put an end to the work of church workers in there. We spoke to her about the impact of the occupation and the way in which Ariel Sharon is using the cover of this war to turn the screws on that occupation. Let's listen to this.
I'm Kristen Schur in Ramallah. Today, Palestinians throughout the West Bank and the Gaza Strip demonstrated in solidarity with the Iraqi people and also demonstrated for themselves. A war has already been waged against the Palestinian people and has been for the last 55 years. And Palestinian people here definitely make the connection between the suffering that the Iraqi people have faced over the past 10 years or so at the hands of the U.S.-imposed sanctions and consistent bombing. In anticipation of this official declaration of war by the U.S., Palestinian people fear the worst for the Iraqi people and for themselves here. The Israeli military government is talking about a full invasion of the Gaza Strip, an area that is already under a constant attack, an essential prison where Palestinians cannot move in and out of at all. Many cannot move freely within the Gaza Strip. The Israeli military government continues to build a wall, apartheid wall, in Rafah, destroying houses, shooting the kids, shooting the people, shooting anything that moves. They're building an apartheid wall also in the West Bank. In so doing, and in continuing the illegal building of Israeli settlements inside of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, they're turning what's left, the small bit of land that the Palestinian people still have left, into cantons, areas that where Palestinians cannot move in and out of, where the Israeli military patrols constantly, stopping people as they try to move. Just going to Ramallah today from Bethlehem, a trip that should take maybe half an hour, took about 5 hours. It took five different taxis. The cars were stopped six or seven times. There were Israeli soldiers pointing their guns at all of the people trying to move, trying to simply go to school, trying to go see their families, trying to do anything. And this is a day that's not under curfew. Under curfew, it's impossible to move at all. These are things the Palestinian people have to face every day. Israeli guns pointed in their faces, children terrified, Apache helicopters in the sky. People are also very afraid of the planes without a driver, the drones that fly overhead taking pictures. Once those pictures are taken, it usually means that the houses will be demolished or else the residents will be abducted. As has been the case every night, it's consistent. The Israeli military swoops into Palestinian towns, particularly in the West Bank right now, and nabs people out of their homes. And when they do this, they break down the doors, sometimes explode the doors. They destroy everything inside of the houses. The children and the families all have to stand outside in the rain now. It's the rainy season. And wait throughout the night as they're all checked, searched, their belongings destroyed, and their family members dragged away. There's over 9,000 political prisoners now, Palestinian political prisoners, being held inside Israeli jails, most of them without charge. Now we see this increase in the amount of prisoners. They're being held usually for about 6 months. It's called administrative detention. As we know, the Israeli military government does not acknowledge international law. It changes the laws in order to suit its own needs. Palestinians are not allowed the opportunity to have trial usually, to see lawyers, family members, to speak on the telephone.
That's the voice of Kristin Schur. She is a special correspondent for Flashpoints, talking to us now from Ramallah on the occupied West Bank in Palestine. Finally, Kristin, could you talk a little bit about the impact specifically on children? You were speaking to us the other day about how one child you were with actually went up and kissed the television because that's the only chance she gets to see her exiled father. Could you talk more about that?
The case that you're specifically talking about is because of the police siege on Bethlehem in the West Bank last April, when Palestinians tried to defend their towns from invading Israeli soldiers. After a 40-day siege, Church of Nativity, the Israeli military government exiled 26 Palestinians from Bethlehem to the Gaza Strip, already an effective prison. These are people that had families, that have families, that are unable to see them, unable to have any sort of relationship anymore, and they have no idea when they're going to be able to come home. The kids that you just mentioned are a family that I know very well, and these children used to ask me, will you go to Gaza and bring home my dad? And, of course, I can't do that, and no one can except the Israeli government at this point. These kids saw father on the television, on Palestine TV. They kissed the television. The infant has never seen the father. There's a photograph of him on the wall in the living room. And the mother says, where's dad? And the baby looks up at the picture now. And so she wonders, and so do many of the family members, if the baby ever sees his father, if he'll know who he is, or if he'll just think that he's an imposter and still be looking to the photograph. 60% of children are suffering from anemia, and they're getting this because they have no appetite, because they're so nervous, they're unable to eat. Kids are also experiencing 50% of bedwetting, inability to sleep throughout the night, nightmares. Of course, when the Israeli military attacks a town or sweeps in, it terrorizes everyone, and throughout the night no one can sleep, and people are just up all night, and that includes the kids. They can't go to school because of the constant closure and constant curfew. There's nothing for them to do. So they play in the camps or play in the streets if they can go outside of the houses, but a lot of the time they just all have to sit inside of the house, and really it just looks like the kids are going crazy at this point. There's nothing for them to do anymore.
All right, Kristen Schur speaking to us on this national anti-war teach-in on Pacifica Radio. She is our special correspondent for Flashpoints, and we thank you for being with us, and please be careful.
Thank you very much. غرامك وتكتر علي
And you are listening to Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. I host a program on in California and Texas called Flashpoints. It's at flashpoints.net. This is a national Pacifica teach-in that talks about the threat of war against Iraq and also the global resistance to that threat. And we are focusing now on the Palestine connection. Virtually is nothing is said about this repressive situation, this intensified occupation. The contradictions are immense, and we're going to talk about them now. We're going to start with Joel Bainan. He's back in the studio with us. He knows a good deal about the situation. He is a professor at Stanford, back and forth to that region. Joel, you want to address a little bit about what Kristen is saying and what we need to know about this?
Actually, I want to talk about the American angle on all of this and how it is that neoconservative Americans with strong ties to the Likud have in their own minds been tying together intensified occupation and repression of the Palestinians with a war against Iraq. So, for example, there is a think tank called the Institute for Advanced Strategic Studies, which has branches in Washington and in Jerusalem. And in July of 1996, just after the Likud Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu came into office, Richard Perle, who is now the chair of the Defense Advisory Board, and Douglas Feith, who is now number three person at the Department of Defense, and David Wormser, who is a special assistant to John Bolton, who is Undersecretary of State for Arms Control, which in the Bush administration is an oxymoron, all wrote a paper for Benjamin Netanyahu entitled "A Clean Break: A New Strategy for Securing the Realm," and what the Clean Break paper advocates is, first, that Israel abandon the Oslo peace process, which was going on at that time, and simply occupy the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Second, the Clean Break paper argues that removing Saddam Hussein from power in Iraq is an Israeli strategic objective in its own right. And the logic here is that Israel should promote the reinstallation of the Hashemite monarchy, which was ousted from Iraq in 1958, and then there might be a joint Jordanian-Iraqi Hashemite monarchy, and that Hashemite monarchy might become the custodian of the Palestinian Bantustans, which would be left in the areas of the West Bank that Israel chose not to annex to Israel proper. So there has been a line of thinking connecting an attack on Iraq with a Likud approach to the Palestinians from at least the mid-1990s. Another group of neoconservatives organized themselves in 1997 in an outfit called the Project for a New American Century, which is headed by William Kristol, who is the editor of the right-wing Weekly Standard. The people involved in a Project for a New American Century include Elliot Abrams, the convicted Iran-Contra conspirator, who is now the National Security Advisor for Middle East Affairs, Paul Wolfowitz, who is Donald Rumsfeld's deputy at the Pentagon, John Bolton, the Undersecretary of State for Arms Control, Richard Perle, chairman of the Defense Policy Board, Richard Armitage, who's Colin Powell's deputy at the State Department, Zalmay Khalilzad, who's a former UNICAL consultant and Bush's ambassador to Afghanistan and now special envoy to the Middle East, and also Dick Cheney and his chief of staff, Louis Libby, were involved in the Project for a New American Century. In early 1998, the Project for a New American Century people sent letters to both Newt Gingrich and who was then Speaker of the House, and Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott, urging that they act aggressively to turn American policy towards the project of overturning the regime of Saddam Hussein. They had earlier sent similar messages to President Clinton, who didn't listen to them. So here again is a big crowd of people who are currently policymakers in the Bush administration, many of them with close ties on the record to the Likud, who have been urging a war on Iraq since the late 1990s. President Bush himself, and many of these figures as well, decided that they were going to launch this war against Iraq, irrespective of any evidence, irrespective of September 11th, in the days and weeks after September 11th. And they were encouraged to do so by Ariel Sharon, who came to the United States shortly after the September 11th attacks, showed full solidarity with the United States, basically told President Bush, now you know what it's like to be an Israeli. We've been fighting terrorism like this for dozens of years. We are going to be with you. It's us against them, the free world against the barbaric terrorists. And the Bush administration has bought this rhetoric, and this is now become an important cement that ties together Israel and the United States against both the Palestinians and the Iraqi people.
That's Dr. Joel Bainon of Stanford University, and we're going to hear from Lamis Andoni, and then we're going to go to the phone and Ali Abu Nima. But first, I just want to add this about Elliot Abrams. The thing that concerns me about this guy's role, not only did he throw the Constitution in the garbage as an Iran-Contra convict, but one of the things that he did in that role, I used to refer to him as the Assistant Secretary of State for Inter-American Lying. One of the other things that this man did was cover up massacres all over Central America. That was his job, to slap the lid on massacres carried out with the support of the U.S. government. So what do we expect that this man is going to do when these massacres in Palestine start to grow? Lamis Andoni.
Yes, I just want to add to the important information that Joel Bainon talked about. First of all, that plan that Pearl wrote was originally written, a similar one was written in 1982 by the Likud and published by World Zionist Organizations, and with the same ideas. And the aim was also to get rid of the Palestinian issue and have a substitute homeland in Jordan under an Iraq, under a Hashemite custodian again, Hashemite rule of Iraq. I want to add that Pearl and Company did not just write these important and dangerous papers. They acted upon them. First of all, after that famous letter that Joe talked about that was signed by many people, including Senator McCain and Lieberman, in addition to the list that Joel talked about, that was the basis for the Iraqi Liberation Act, which was passed by the Congress, by the Senate, thanks to Trent Lott. So their lobbying did succeed in reviving the by then discredited INC led by Jalabi and getting the administration to fund Jalabi. Before that, preparation for the Anti-Liberation Act, other than the letters, Wolfowitz and Khalil Zad jointly wrote a series of articles that you could find in the Weekly Standard, pointing out, in fact, outlining a plan to take over Iraq. So even in 97, in addition to that, what Pearl did, he started something, the Lebanon, Free Lebanon Committee, which he included Fiyth in it and other Israeli Likudniks, as part of the plan on how to destabilize Syria using Maronite right-wing elements that are collaborating with Israel. Interestingly enough, Jalabi was included in that committee. The other step that Pearl took, which predated his plan, was the co-founding of JINSA, the Jewish International Security Agency. And the aim of JINSA was to integrate Israeli goals, particularly Likud goals, security goals, into a national American defense program. And that's what's happening now. What we're seeing is a convergence of interests in the Middle East and elsewhere between the Likud and the Hawks. I want just to add that there are different meanings for rearranging the Middle East. Rolling back Syria, controlling Iraq, and even maybe dividing Saudi Arabia is one of them, and of course ending the idea of a Palestinian state and Palestinian sovereignty. But Bernard Lewis, the ideologue of all of them, have talked about the disintegration of the whole Arab world, the end of the Arab world as we know it. So it goes much beyond that. Once these new entities are created and emphasizing the ethnic and religious differences, then Israel would be the only country in the Middle East, according to Lewis, and together with Turkey, that are viable states. That will be the end of the Arab world and Arab identity, and we know it. And that's a big victory for Israel from their point of view.
That's Lamise Andoni, independent reporter, has done 2 decades of reporting for many newspapers in the Middle East. Also joining us is Ali Abunima. He is the co-founder of the new web portal electronicirak.net. Ali Abunima, I believe you're in Chicago, Ali?
Yes, I am.
First of all, you can comment on what you've heard, and then I want you to talk a little bit about the role of the mainstream media in suppressing any real information about what's happening in terms of the occupation of Palestine.
Well, I want to make a general comment, given what I think an important day this is in history, that London is witnessing the largest peacetime demonstration ever, and perhaps the largest demonstration ever that's been recorded there, and a million people in Rome, thousands in Chicago. My sister is telling us from New York, where she is, that at least 500,000 turned out there. And what I think is significant is that this is the first time people are really mobilizing on such a mass scale before a war starts. And I think that that's very hopeful, because over the past couple of years of this administration, things have been getting more and more depressing. And we've been saying, where's the opposition? And here it is. And I think another thing that's very hopeful when we look at Israel-Palestine is the decision of the Belgian Supreme Court last week to allow the trial of Ariel Sharon to go ahead after he leaves office, after he no longer has immunity as a head of government. And so those are points where I think it just goes to show that